Today is the new moon day, and also, as everyone who's resident here is well aware, the last few days we've been reconfiguring the location of the monastery kitchen. So during these previous few weeks, the retreat center kitchen and various rooms have been kindly offered for the community's use, co-opted for the community's use during this time. And then over the last few days, and through a lot of effort and careful planning and consideration, not only was the kitchen refurbishment completed, but then also all of the life of the sala has been reconstituted, reinstituted, and the new kitchen is all sparkling, spiffy, sort of stainless steel and clean surfaces. Things are rearranged. So that kind of physical engagement, helping to move everything back, tidy everything up, clean the place, and to set everything in order. That kind of communal activity, oftentimes during the winter retreat, when we have so much emphasis on formal practice and sitting, walking, meditation, then there's usually some kind of an issue or a little project or an emergency of some kind that helps everyone to get out and move some muscles and carry some objects around. So at the Abhayagiri monastery where I was before, it would often be something like a large oak tree being brought down by the snow or by heavy rains and falling across the pathway. And so we'd have a couple of days of chopping up a large tree and stacking firewood. Here we've had the kitchen moving. And there's a certain joyfulness and also a delight being able to serve and to engage physically, just to be bringing the body into action, but also that sense of doing some simple, tangible task that is of benefit to the whole community, that there's a joyfulness that is present in the act of service and giving our energy, our time, our attention, our care, to something that's going to be of benefit to others. To be acting unselfishly as an automatic source of happiness, of joy within us. That's a direct and natural connection that is there. Also reflecting on this process, both in drawing up the preparations for reconfiguring the kitchen. As people probably know, we had to reconfigure the kitchen and bring in more amenities like the extractor fans and having automatic cutoffs for the gas supply and so on and so forth, in order to meet with the insurance company's requirements, the health and safety requirements, to be in compliance with the law, otherwise we would be shut down. So there wasn't really a huge amount of choice about the need to improve the amenities. But exactly how we did it took a great deal of thought, many meetings, many hours of meetings with the building committee and the kitchen people, and lots of pieces of paper with little rectangles and arrows drawn over them. Many hours of discussion and conversation, and a lot of thoughtfulness put into how things are set up. And then also how to decommission the old kitchen at the beginning of the retreat, set things up new in the retreat center, and then over the last few days, decommission the retreat center kitchen, move back over again. This all requires a lot of structure. This all requires a great deal of careful thought, where in that process, if you consider it, there's a lot of concepts are needed, a lot of forms, a lot of human agreements, just agreeing, okay, If the work is finished on Friday the 17th, then that means that over the 18th, 19th, 20th, 21st, then this, and this will need to happen. So it's important to consider all of that work very, very smoothly, and I certainly applaud the various community members who helped it all to happen, particularly Jonas and Sister Tisara, Tanapamado, Hannah, also Lee Woods of masterminding the whole program, and everybody else, all the rest of us who lent a hand. It's important to consider, we all had to come to agreements. Okay, on this day we're going to do this, on that day we're going to do that. Okay, so now from tomorrow morning, where we go for breakfast is the sala, not the retreat center kitchen. If you go to the retreat center kitchen, you'll be disappointed. You probably feel foolish as well. But these structures, these forms, these agreements, you know, it all went very smoothly because things seemed to be very well set up and beautifully done in the new kitchen in the sala, because of the skillful manipulation of conditions. You know, thinking things through, coming up with structures that are practical, that are going to work, that are going to be in accordance with people's capacities, the limitations, what complies with the law, and so on and so forth. So this is important to consider, how when we come to agreements, when we think things through, when we see what's going to be a benefit to ourselves and others, and we all go along with those agreements, then things work very smoothly, and beneficial things can be brought into existence. We can make our life and the conditions of our life say something that is of a supportive and helpful quality. So that this is in a way that the aspect of our training and our practice to do with Vinaya and to do with schedules and community structures, to see how when we take the conditioned world, we take the world of forms and ideas, concepts, words, and then we apply them skillfully. We approach them, pick them up in a skillful way. We pick them up and use them in a way that is in accord with other people's perspectives. We're taking into account not just our own points of view and our own experience, but that of others as well. Then things can be done in a very, very pleasant and helpful way. So the work projects organized for these last few days has all gone very, very smoothly, and people seemingly, as far as I can tell, have had an enjoyable time. It's been a delight to be able to help it to happen and to be involved. So this is good to consider. This is when conditions are adjusted and worked with in a skillful way, then what results is not only useful developments on the material front, things that are supportive, that create a quality of sapaya, or convenience, pleasantness in the living situation, but also along the way they are enjoyable and a support for our practice. So when we consider the teachings and we look at the Dhamma, we can, it's very easy to think, well, what really matters is the unconditioned. You know, this is the unborn, the unconditioned, the uncreated. This is what really matters. The ultimate Dhamma, the true Satya Dhamma, this is the only thing that is of real significance. And so, and in a way, that's true. You know, we gear our attention, our efforts, we set our intentions towards realizing the unconditioned, the unborn, the uncreated, and this is a central theme of our practice. And so it can, in that respect, it can make it look as though that the born, the conditioned, the created, the formed is this kind of irritating obstruction. And you know, we can easily pick it up or relate to the world of the senses, the conditioned world, in that way. Just as in that famous teaching of the Buddha from the Udana that Lumpur is so fond of, Lumpur Sumato is so fond of, there is the unborn, the unconditioned, the unformed, the uncreated. And if there were not this unborn, unformed, unconditioned, uncreated, then escape from the born, the formed, the conditioned, the created would not be possible. But because there is this unborn, unoriginated, unformed, uncreated, therefore escape is possible from the formed, the conditioned, the born, the created. So that, and this is a wonderful and powerful teaching, and I'm certainly not disagreeing with it. But we can pick it up in such a way that we can look down upon the world of form or the world of the senses. Oh, it's just a conditioned world. It's only a concept. It's just an idea. It's just the sense world. Pah! And to sort of brush that aside or poo-poo that, to dismiss that, to make little of it. But it's also important to consider that the conditioned world also includes things like our Vinaya training, the rules of training, the Sikkhapada, that we all agree to. Similarly, like these are a set of human agreements that we undertake to live by. For the monastics, the 8 precepts, 10 precepts, 227 precepts, 150 precepts of the Sila Dhara, or the lay community, the 8 precepts that people did the recollection of this evening. These are part of the conditioned world. And so in exactly the same way, when we pick those up and apply them, we recognize the Sikkhapada, the training precepts, and we all agree to follow along and to guide our lives in accordance with those precepts to the extent that we are capable of being mindful, not getting distracted. Then we are able to live harmoniously with each other. We're able to live respectfully and easefully with each other. So these are also aspects of the conditioned world. The routine we have, the schedule that we have for the retreat, the Sikkhapada that we live by, the roles of Sangha officers that we have within the community, both in the monastics and the lay support team, the lay managers, all of us who dwell here at Amaravati. These are all part of the conditioned world, and when we pick up and use those aspects of form in a skillful way, then life flows along very, very smoothly, very simply, and we can create an environment that is supportive for awakening. Just as in one of the readings of Lumpur Cha's teachings that we had a day or two ago, he said, every place is a place that is suitable for practice. But living in a forest monastery, living in a quiet place in the country, that helps to set conditions whereby we can apply ourselves most directly to that. It creates a helpful environment, a supportive set of conditions, which is not to be ignored. That is a significant element. So in this respect, then, it's important to not look down upon concepts and structures and forms and to think of this, this is just the stuff that gets in the way, and what really matters is the unborn, the unconditioned, the uncreated. But there's a way that we need to learn how to pick up and to use, to hold the conditioned, the formed, the born, the created, so that then we help to sustain that environment is conducive to peacefulness, that environment which is conducive to respectfulness and ease of living between ourselves and other people. This was a question or a comment that somebody made at one of the readings, how you know, so many ideas, so many teachings, so many words. You know, do we really need all this stuff, or doesn't all this stuff just sort of create a confusion or clutter? Isn't it all getting in the way essentially? And I would say that's a dangerous idea to pick up, because the Buddha spent 45 years teaching. There's a lot of words in the Tripitaka. Many, many thousands, millions of words of Dhamma and Vinaya in the Tripitaka. And that the Buddha taught, and all those who followed after, the great teachers and sages who followed after, have to a great extent used words and used the structures, living structures, to help carry on the teachings, to help, you know, make the opportunity available for people to transform their lives, for us here today, now, in this community present at this very moment, that it's through those very concepts and ideas, those forms, that all of us are here in this hall today. All of us are here, whether we're residents or just visitors for the day, and whether we're taking formal monastic commitments, or whether we're just here temporarily as a layperson. You know, all of us are here because of the verbal teachings, or all of us here because of the living structures. So that I would say, rather than all of the words, all the verbiage just being intrinsically something which is confusing or just cluttering up the picture, or which is just endless piles of stuff that accumulates, like all the extra kitchen gear that is accumulating under the sala and becoming homes for all sorts of creatures. Stuff can just become stuff, just clutter that does clog up the works. But if we understand how the conditioned and the unconditioned relate with each other, and we put that realization of the unconditioned at the center, but you know, as we do that, we also don't reject or neglect the nature of the conditioned. Then we realize that what helps the unconditioned to be realized is having the conditioned world arranged in a way that maximizes the possibility of the realization of the unconditioned. It creates an environment that is supportive and helpful, encouraging to the heart, to the mind, to awaken, to know, and to not be distracted by secondary things. So, you know, that's why in living in this place and training, then we do put a lot of emphasis on the routine, on carrying out our particular jobs with diligence and care. If you're the stores person, or you're the office person, or you're the guest person, or you're you're looking after a particular cleaning job, that you do it with great care and diligence and application, and that there's an encouragement to carry out our tasks, our roles with great heartfulness and sincerity, to not sort of dismiss those things. But also, you know, I think one of the reasons that people make those kind of comments about this is all just concepts, or this is all just stuff, you know, what really matters is insight. What really matters is our sort of fundamental human qualities, is because we can get over-absorbed, we can get overtaken up with our particular jobs, our particular roles, whether we are a layperson, or we're in charge of the office, or the grounds, or the kitchen, or the buildings, or we're the guest nun, or the work monk, or the senior monk, the ajahn in charge of this, or the nun in charge of that. We can get over-involved and obsessed, caught up, entangled in our particular activities, or our roles, our status, how many rains we've got. You know, one rains, two rains, no rains. We're a layperson on the way to becoming an Anagarika, or Anagarika on the way to becoming a Siladhara, or, you know, Majjhima on the way to becoming an Ajahn. We can get very wrapped up in those forms and structures, and so that at that point, when we get wrapped up, when entanglement happens, that's when it becomes burdensome. That's when it turns into clutter and creates the causes for confusion and obstruction. Then those very forms and routines and structures, they do feel burdensome, and it's to the extent that we turn those forms and structures, concepts, into personal possessions, when it becomes our identity. I am a senior monk, or I am a junior nun, I am in charge of the library, I am the kitchen manager, yeah, I am looking after the vehicles. That's who and what I am. This is my territory. And it just happens so easily, doesn't it? Like I was talking with one of the people on the lay support crew, and how there's a particular place where he likes to park his car. He comes here all the time. And this is where I park. This is my place. This is where I park my car. And he said how it's always surprising to him when it's a festival day and the parking marshal with their green jacket, you know, point him and say, no, you have to drive through, you know, through the gate and out and park in the field. And something would rise up and say, but this is my, I always park here, this is my place, I park here. You know, as if every blade of grass in that little spot has Nick's parking space written on it. You know, this is my spot. But that's what happens, you know, it's at first it's an arbitrary choice, and then before you know it, it's become my place, you know, my cushion, my spoon. I'm supposed to be doing the washing up. You're drying. It's on the list. I'm washing. You're drying. You know, please hand over that. You know, hand over that dirty saucepan. That's mine. Obviously, yeah. That you know, an arbitrary circumstance turns into a personal territory, and we get entangled. We get caught up, and the degree to which we make it personal, the degree to which we identify with it, is the degree to which there is stress and burden and dukkha. It's a direct relationship. It's a carefully balanced equation. The degree of identification and clinging is directly proportional to the degree of dukkha. So what that means is that when we carry out our duties and we relate to our activities, we relate to our meditation practice and the people that we live with and the world around us, that we need to keep that in balance and to help to keep that quality of the unconditioned, the unborn, the unformed, the inconceivable, the unnameable, to keep that at the center, so that it's important to have that element of the practice and the ways of contemplation, the way of guiding our attitude towards things, towards activities, towards people, towards our body, our mind, to be reminding ourselves, you know, to hold it in that appropriate perspective, so that we are able to relate to the world of forms and conditions and structures with sincerity and heartfulness, but without entanglement, without identification, without confusion. One of the teachings that we're reading out, a couple of them actually, of Lumpur Cha's, is one of the themes that he touches on quite often, is how he'd say something like, why do we get confused? Why do we get caught up? Why is our practice difficult? It's because we don't really understand things clearly. And what don't we understand? And he said, well, take for example, hair. See, if you really contemplate hair, you just take one hair from your own head, and if you really know that hair, then you know all hair. You know what hair is, whether it's on, whether it's your hair or anybody else's hair, it's just hair. Similarly, you know, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin. When you know one example of it, then you know all of it. Similarly with people, when you know, if you really know one person, if you really know what a person is, if you just know what one person is, then you know all people. If you really know what a person is, then you know what all people are. And I know that some people hearing this might think that philosophically that's a bit of a leap, a bit of a leap to make. But you know, Buddhist teachings are always given in the spirit of being for contemplation and reflection. But it's so totally matter of fact in the way that Lumpo Cha expresses it. It's absolutely obvious to him. So it's just taking up that spirit of obviousness of, well, of course, you know, any fool can see. If you really know one person, you know all people. And in that sense of not knowing all the details of our lives and our stories and our personal histories and so forth, but knowing that a human body is just earth, water, fire, and wind. It's just the four elements: solidity, fluidity, cohesion, heat and vibration. That's what makes up the world of form. Yeah, there's a body, there's a mind. Yeah, and that there's a very powerful and wonderful leveling quality in that. And he uses the example of saying, you know, like the medicines that you get. And in those days, that very popular amongst the villagers and I think to a certain extent amongst the monastics, there are a couple of kinds of analgesic, sort of general perking up medicines. One was called Bodhai, meaning that which cures illnesses, Bodhai, and another called Tamjai. He said, you know, Bodhai, Tamjai, you know, they come in different packets, but basically it's the same stuff. It's exactly the same for people. You know, they come in different packets, you know, woman packet, man packet, old packet, young packet, you know, Thai packet, Farang packet. You know, old, young, tall, short, male, female, different nationalities. It's all pretty much the same stuff. You know, Bodhai, Tamjai, Beecham's powders, Lemsip. It's all pretty much the same stuff, really. Just different packets. So I found contemplating that teaching, that's so helpful, because what it is doing is it's helping to level out and to counteract the partiality that our minds create. Judging, like, oh, this is a lay person, this is a monastic, this is a man, this is a woman, this is an old person, this is a young person. Or judging people by the roles that they play in society, or where they live in the pecking order, in the state, what sort of status they have, whether they're attractive or unattractive, whether they're rich or poor, whether they're, you know, famous or not. You know, that when you say, oh, it's all just pretty much the same stuff, you know, slightly different packaging, but it's all just Bodhai, Tamjai, Beecham's powders, Lemsip, you know, it's all just basically the same gear, really. Earth, water, fire, and wind. Nothing to get excited about, nothing to get irritated by. And so I find an extraordinarily useful reflection, because we can see how very partial and biased our minds can become, how very strong our perceptions are, like the conventions of, that's my parking spot, you know. Yeah, I always park there, that's my place. Yeah, that's mine. You know, this, we were so subject to that. Or, that's a really interesting person, that's a really famous person. Yeah. Well, that's a, you know, really uninteresting person. This is a really inspiring person. That's a really depressing person. Or looking at ourselves, you know, I'm really sick. I'm really, you know, I'm feeling in great shape. Or I'm getting old. Or I wish I wasn't the shape that I am. I wish I was more flexible. I wish I didn't have so much pain in my knee or my legs or my back. Or I wish I had better eyesight. I wish I could hear better. A lot of deafness in the Sangha these days, as an aging population. If only my ears really worked. So it's a way of helping to see that all of those judgments, interesting, uninteresting, high status, low status, healthy, sick, female, male, English, French, German, Finnish, Belgian, Sri Lankan, Italian, Hungarian, Portuguese, Japanese, Afghani, yeah, any of the varieties of nationalities that we have here at Amaravati, that we are able to remember, oh, well, that's just the packaging. It's just Bhutai, Tamjai, Beechman's Powders, Lemsip. You know, it doesn't really make much difference. English, Nigerian, Finnish, Hungarian, Portuguese, Sri Lankan, Thai. Yeah, pretty much the same. Woman, man, old, young, tall, short, monastic layperson. Yeah, it's just earth, water, fire, wind. How could it not be? It's all pretty much the same stuff. And again, you know, I'm sure many of your minds are saying, well, hang on a minute now, just a moment. It's much more complicated than that. But you know, if you think about it, you know, all of our bodies, what are our bodies made of? If you just go back to your school chemistry classes, our bodies are made of nothing except electrons, neutrons, and protons. Yeah, every atom, every molecule in our body is just electrons, neutrons, protons. That's what, you know, atoms are made up of. Yeah, bits of space. You say, yeah, what about all those quarks, though? All those, you know, other kind of esoteric subatomic particles. Well, just, yeah, okay. But basically, as a thumbnail sketch, all of our bodies are just made of the same stuff. They're just the same quarks, up, down, up quarks, down quarks. Electrons, protons, neutrons, that's all it is. And they get configured to be male, to be female. They get configured, so we call them old, we call them young, we give them different names, we give them different rooms to stay in, we carry out certain ceremonies that we agree upon that have validity as a social form. So we call that, you know, when those ceremonies have been carried out and those commitments have been made, then that we call that being ordained as a monastic, as a nun, or as a monk. But it's all, these are just working upon this ideas around electrons, protons, neutrons. You know, this is what it means to say it's just earth, water, fire, and wind. It's just these aspects of the material form. And that's true. You know, that's the way it is. That's the physical reality of it. So when we remember that, we recollect those aspects of, you know, who and what we are and what the world is, then we see this quality of upekar, or evenness, as a great leveling and emptying that occurs. It's in that moment, the heart is being emptied out of its biases, of its preferences, of its preoccupations. And we are able to see those in perspective. So there's still, you know, there's still masculinity, there's still ordination, there's still nationality and so forth. You know, all those things still apply, but we see them as transparent. We see them as agreements that have been made. There's no thing that's permanent and solid and that is completely and absolutely there. So then we're able to hold those conventions in a skillful way, and then they really serve us. They serve the triple gem, they serve the sangha, they support our lives, and they create the most helpful forms of sapaya, of conducive environment that can be done. So this is a helpful recollection to bear in mind, and something that, again, you have to put it into action to make it work, as is often pointed out. We have to remember to think, oh no, it's just earth, water, fire, and wind. This person, that person, this body, you know, these different moods that we have, being enthusiastic, being depressed, being excited, being sad. These are all just, again, it's pretty much the same, just moods coming and going, It's just mood stuff, that's all. You know, no big thing. Nothing to get excited over, nothing to get worried about. Just a mood. The judgments that we make of, you know, approving, disapproving, this is good, that's bad, this is beautiful, that's ugly, I like, I want, I don't like, I don't want. Just to be able to see, oh, it's just the wanting stuff, it's just that, it's just a feeling, you know, no big thing, nothing to get excited about or upset about. So when we apply those simple reflections, we work on our attitude, our attitudinal habits in that way, it makes a huge difference. It has a tremendously lightening and clarifying quality. Well, last week, as people know, I had, speaking of people, I had the opportunity to meet Queen Elizabeth and the Duke of Edinburgh and a lot of other high-ranking people. Lots of purple and scarlet, long beards amongst the religious luminaries of Britain and Ireland that were there. It was a gathering. It was the opening event of the year's Jubilee celebrations for the Queen's Diamond Jubilee, 60 years on the throne. And so in some respects, you know, say the Queen is a really special person, you know, she's a Your Majesty, you know, she's Her Majesty. But then there were, and the Archbishop of Canterbury, His Grace, the Archbishop, and all sorts of other high-ranking religious types of various kinds, Hindus, Sikhs, Muslims, Baha'i, Zoroastrian, the Jewish community, very many, many different kinds of Christians, Catholics, Church of Scotland, Church of Ireland, Coptic Church, Greek Orthodox Church, many, many different varieties of Christians. And the gathering together at Lambeth Palace in order to express support and to celebrate the Queen's role as a monarch and head of the nation for 60 years. So personally, I feel felt quite honoured, and I'm very glad to go along, because the Queen is very definitely a worthy person. She's someone who's conducted herself extraordinarily well, with exemplary dignity and care and unselfishness. And people might complain, and I know I did myself, as in my sort of hairy student days. I used to ride around on my bicycle in London as a hairy student with a shirt with Sod the Jubilee. This was 1977, was the 25th anniversary of the Queen's time on the throne. So I had the fellow I shared a flat with, but he was much more of anti-royalist type. So we made up these shirts that had Sod the Jubilee written across the back in large red letters. And so we were making our little protest, our feelings felt. But I feel far more sympathetic towards Queen Elizabeth, and 35 years have gone by, and I've probably grown up a little bit in the interim, since I was a arrogant 20-year-old at that time. And I see that someone in her situation, it might seem that she, you know, she's extraordinarily rich and lives in great luxury, and so people might think her very, very privileged. But also, her life is one of continual surrender. You know, she really doesn't have a life of her own. You know, every day she has to fit in with the schedules that are worked out for her. She never gets a day off from being queen. Just as we never, you know, us monastics, we never get a day off from being a monastic. You know, the Queen has been doing the Queen job for 60 years without a day off. And other sort of lesser royals can disappear off to a tropical island and just fool around on the beach for a bit. But the Queen is always perpetually in the public eye, and the only places she can go on holidays is to her own places, like, you know, Sandringham or Balmoral. And that, so in a sense, even though she is immensely rich and lives in luxurious circumstances, I'd say her life has been one of surrender, you know, as a renunciation in many respects, that she's had to give up all her wishes for any kind of anonymity or normality and just give herself to the role of being the monarch. And I feel she's been a real rock, a real mountain for the people of this country, someone who's very honourable, very dependable, someone who is very sincere. And so I feel she's done an extraordinary job, and someone who's very worthy of respect, worthy of honour. And so I'm very glad to be part of, touched to be invited to be part of this event with Bhante Sila Vimala and other members of the Buddhist community. So, you know, in this respect, you know, the Queen is someone who is, you think, well, she's a very special person. But also, just like the Queen and also the cardinals that were there and the rabbis and the various bishops, you know, and different archbishops and church types. You know, when you look around the room and you see all this purple and scarlet and these, you know, long white beards and glorious array, it's all just earth, water, fire and wind. I mean, how could it not be? I mean, the Archbishop of Canterbury's body is still made up of electrons and neutrons and protons. He might have a very fancy purple cassock, you know, very spiffy. The cardinals have all these kind of Catholic cardinals, these scarlet bits to their gear. Whether you're by faith and by commitment, you're a rabbi or you're an imam or you're a Zoroastrian priest or a Buddhist monk or a member of the Church of England or Church of Scotland, Church of Ireland, or a Lutheran bishop, a woman bishop from the Lutheran Church, a very interesting character. But still, it's just earth, water, fire, and wind. You know, just how could it not be? It's the clothing, the bodies, the room, Lambeth Palace, with all of the portraits of the former archbishops of Canterbury over the many, many centuries gathered around the walls. It's all just, you know, earth, water, fire, and wind. Just as these bodies, and also the temple, the stones that we sit on, the oak of this Dharma seat, the oak pillars, the candles, the flames, yeah, the Buddha Rupa, the air, it's all just earth, water, fire, wind, the four elements coming, going, changing. Earth element inside, earth element outside, it's all just earth element. Air, fire, water, inside, outside, it's just air element, water element, fire element. But still, it was a delightful event to be a part of, and one of the things that I was very struck by, both in the comments that the Queen made and the Archbishop, and also the very fact that this sort of opening event for the Jubilee year, it was a very, very consciously and deliberately an event that was all faiths were represented equally. So it was very much, Here is the UK, here is the United Kingdom in its characteristic as a multicultural and multi-faith society. This is the Britain of today. It's not just the Church of England. it's a multicultural society. There's many, many different nationalities and creeds and ways of life that are lived and practiced here. And that I felt it was very beautiful and skillful that they chose to open the Jubilee, the celebration of the Queen's 60 years on the throne, by respecting that quality of cultural diversity, a religious diversity within Britain. And also the Queen's made this very significant statement that she's the, for those who you don't know, even though she's the Queen, she's also the head of the Church of England, so she's the supreme governor of the Church of England, so she's above the Archbishop of Canterbury in terms of being the head of the church. And she made this very significant statement, which was that she said that the role of the Church of England was not just to promote the cause of Anglican Christianity, like Church of England brand Christianity, but rather the role of the Church of England as the sort of dominant spiritual force and the ruling, and her job as the head of the Church of England, was to protect and to ensure that everybody who lives in this country can practice according to their own faith. So it's an interesting thing that the one of the titles that the Queen has is Fidei Defensor, which means, you see on the coins, Fid Def, that comes from the Latin Fidei Defensor, which means defender of the faith, which a previous pope gave to Henry VIII before Henry VIII split from split from Rome. Fidei Defensor, defender of the faith. But it's really clear that what she sees the role, her role, and also the role of the church, is to be the defender of the faiths, plural. Then it's to be a defender and protector of all faiths. I felt that was a sign of great maturity and a grandeur of vision and a grandeur of heart, a broadness of attitude and of vision. Seeing that the health of the nation is not just giving a priority or superiority to one particular group, but the health of the nation depends on people being able to practice and to pursue their own faiths in an environment of security and support and respect. So I felt that was a very significant element in and also the spirit of the gathering. Now also, the fact is that when you have a lot of those guys gathered together, the Buddhists, we're quite well known for not being too argumentative with other religious groups. But many of the groups gathered there had a lot of historical antipathy between them, between the Jews and the Christians. The Christians have mistreated the Jewish community and looked down upon the Jewish community and hated and vilified the Jewish community for many, many centuries in Europe and the Middle East. So a lot of possibilities for tension there then between the Church of England and the Roman Catholic Church. Henry VIII split from Rome in the middle of the 16th century. St. Margaret's Convent up the lane was shut down and sacked. And all the monasteries around Britain were closed, and the Church of England got started. So that was in 1540 something. Before that, then the Orthodox and the Catholics, they split from each other in the Great Schism of 1053, I think it was. The Great Schism, and they excommunicated each other. 1053 or 1056, back in the 11th century. So, but everyone was there. And then the Muslims and the Hindus, both represented by Indian people from the Indian subcontinent. So a lot of historical friction, tension between many of the groups there, and so you think, well, how can we all get along, and how does it really work? We can all be polite and friendly when we're sipping tea and eating biscuits together in Lambeth Palace, but also just that sense of where is the commonality. And how do we find a real place of meeting? And I was having a conversation with the Archbishop's wife, who was also helping to host the event, Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams's wife, and she was a very interesting person. So we were talking about this, and also because of our religious beliefs being so widely different between the Christians and the Muslims and the Hindus and the Jews and the Zoroastrians and Buddhists and the Sikhs, such a, you know, varied doctrines and principles. And I was reminded of one of these Buddhist conferences we had with the Dalai Lama in Dharamsala back in the 90s. And I think it was the first one of these. And during the course of this conference, they had come up with the idea of laying out a short list of principles, guidelines for Buddhist teachers in the West. And so that various people in the conference had undertaken to help pull that together. Stephen Batchelor and Jack Kornfield and Sylvia Borstein and a few others worked on creating this little document. And so the idea was to present this to His Holiness at the end of the conference and to see if he agreed with what we'd come up with and if he would like to put his stamp of approval on it and saying, yeah, I think these are good principles which all Buddhist teachers should adhere to, and these are good principles to go by. And why I was reminded of it was that I think Stephen Batchelor was the one who was presenting it to him at the end. We're all gathered there in this reception room, this meeting hall in the Dalai Lama's monastery in Dharamsala. And so he starts off, point number one, our first duty as Buddhist teachers is to practice and promote the teaching of the Buddha. And the Dalai Lama just chimes in, no, that's completely wrong, totally wrong. That's not our duty at all. And so after they spent 2.5 days working on this document, halfway through the first sentence, like, stop, wrong. So that got everyone's attention. And he said, our first duty as Buddhists is not to promote Buddhism, not at all. That's our first duty as Buddhists is to promote human goodness. That's what we are. If we're going to promote something, that's what we should be promoting. It's not our job to. We shouldn't be thinking that we're trying to convert other people to be Buddhists. And this look on his face was like completely horrified. Like, what? Yeah. How could you be so arrogant or stupid to think everyone should be a Buddhist? How ridiculous! What are you guys thinking of? You know, the Tibetan equivalent of, what the hell are you guys thinking of? And it was very good because it was just so like Ajahn Chah saying, you know, oh, you know, it's obvious, isn't it? You know, it's just it's all pretty much the same stuff. So to the Dalai Lama, it was totally obvious, absolutely without any question, completely obvious. That it's not our priority to try and make everyone into a Buddhist or to promote Buddhism, but you know, rather to promote human kindness, human goodness, and so that that's what I'm talking with the people there at this gathering in Lambeth. It was that's what really struck me that what was gathered together in that room, whether we were dressed as Sikhs or Jews or Muslims or Buddhists or Hindus, or we were a Catholic cardinal, or the Archbishop of the Church of Ireland, or whatever, or the Queen, you know, Duke of Edinburgh, that what was gathered together in that room, that everybody there was very keen on promoting goodness. That's everyone's life, regardless of the particular religious conventions, was centered around encouraging human goodness. And just like the precepts that we have, you know, particularly the first four precepts, to respect life, to not steal, to be responsible in sexual behavior, to not lie, to be honest, and to be respectful in our speech. These are universal human qualities. These are, and I realized that there wasn't a person in the room who would object to in basic principle about there's encouraging goodness, and that was you could see was really the job of everybody who was there. All of the different religious leaders, whether they were of one religion or another, that all of them had a firm commitment to encouraging goodness, and that was something that we all agree on. So that when we were having this conversation, and we were talking about theism and believing in God, and I said, well, it's more helpful if we just think in terms of, you know, I believe in goodness, rather than I believe in God or I don't believe in God. That I believe in the good. Just stick an extra O in, rather than God, calling it good. And that then it's something that we can all agree on, because it's of course there's going to be different opinions about what is good and what's not good. Like killing the heretics might be considered good by by some, but put that aside for the moment. But that sense of the capacity that we have and the common sense that we can draw upon that recognizes, yeah, being honest, you know, not lying to people, not stealing things, not mistreating others, you know, these are universally recognized worthy human qualities, and to be encouraged, and so that you, because they're gathered in that room, just as here, gathered in this temple, it's a kind of generator of human goodness, and the purpose of that kind of a meeting or gathering together here on the observance day is to encourage the capacity that we have to bring forth goodness within ourselves, to strengthen our own love of the good, our own commitment to letting go of the harmful. And it also reminded me of the Ovada Patimokkha, the Magga Puja festival that we'll have in a couple of weeks' time, in the full moon day. The Buddha gave this teaching, the Ovada Patimokkha, his advice to 1,250 arahants. And it's interesting that his advice to the 1,250 arahants was not, you should believe in me, or there is the unborn, the unconditioned, the uncreated, but it was sabba papasa akaranam kusala supasampada sacitta pariyodapanam etang bhutana sasanam. To refrain from all evil, all harmfulness, all unwholesomeness, to cultivate the good, to bring into being the good, the kusala, sacitta pariyodapanam, to purify the heart. This is the teaching of all the Buddhas. So what he was encouraging was human goodness, just even advice to arahants, and also the simple practicalities that he goes on in the latter part of that sutta, talking about moderation in eating, not lying down to sleep in public, you know, moderation in eating, moderation in sleeping, just ordinary practical handy hints for the human world. Do good, refrain from harm, purify your heart. These are the key things, and that's something that we can all agree on. So. Yeah, Ajahn Chah used to use the image of a piece of fruit. He said, like, when people would ask him, well, what do you think about Christianity? Or how is Christianity different from Buddhism? Or, you know, and he'd say, well, it's like, you know, when you look at you can think of the conventions and forms of a religion like the skin of the fruit. You know, that if you attach to the forms, it's like, say, having a banana or a tangerine, you know. It's like if you attach to the forms, or you think that the form is the most important thing, or that's what makes all the difference, then it's like, you know, eating the fruit with the skin on, like, you know, biting into a tangerine with the skin still on it, or eating a banana with the skin on. It's that this is not going to taste very good, and it's going to give you indigestion. So the important thing is to peel the fruit, you take the skin off, you look beyond the superficial forms and structures. So looking beyond the conventions of being a theistic religion or non-theistic religion, and to taste the fruit. And so in this respect, that fruit, if you peel the tangerine and eat the fruit, then what you taste and what you're nourished by is that quality of human goodness, that natural love of truth and the attraction of reality, the rejection of the harmful or selfish or destructive, yeah, is intrinsic to our own heart. That's what we taste. So that whether we, if we attach to the forms and make and say, well, you know, the Catholics are really, they're totally different from the Church of England or the Buddhists, or we're totally different from those Muslims. And if we obsess on the forms, then it's rather like the peeling the, you're peeling the fruit and eating the peel. And forgetting the whole human goodness side of it altogether, you're missing the main piece. And so that you attach to your own form and blame and criticize others. But if we just respect our forms and carefully peel it off, then what we find underneath, and when we taste the fruit, is that experience of human goodness, our own natural. A pure heart. And so then when we meet others, whether regardless of their different disposition or their role in the community or whoever they might be, whether they're the Queen of England or whether they're the postman, whether it's the layperson who's looking after the bins, or whether it's the senior members of the community, monastic community. Then what we meet is, and what we encounter, and what we're touched by is that is the human goodness, and that we see that's the universal quality and universally of respect, and so that that's what we see, that's the thing that really matters, and that's what we can touch into, and that the goodness that we see around us is also, it's here within us too. So we remember that's the most important thing about our own lives, our own pure heart. Doesn't matter so much whether we're male or female or monastic or layperson. The inside, we're all pretty much the same. it's all one variety, one brand, and so that's the thing to remember, to recollect, and to be encouraged by. To set that as what you measure your life by and the life of those around you. So I'll offer these thoughts for consideration this evening. Andamayam Dhamma Avadikata Sadhu Kara.